Oh, hi there. I'm Sarah Palin. I was just dropping off some of my albatross mulligatawny so that you could remember to watch my new endangered species hunting and cooking show on Fox News. The show is called Oil and Uzis. It's not just a cooking show. We'll actually teach you how to stalk and kill wild game and tip the balance of the ecosystem in your favor for a change. Yeah. We'll also talk to important guests on my show, like our first guest, the Reverend Thomas Muthy, who's going to take us deep into his prayer cave and find out why God wants me to be president. We'll also talk about why God chose me to be rich and how poor folks just aren't chosen by God like rich people are. Am I right? You betcha. But as a Christian, I have to say that my heart goes out to all of the folks in Haiti. Can you imagine it living in a country like Haiti? Sweet Jesus. They have no infrastructure, no roads, no hospitals. I mean, it's like they were living without any kind of regulation at all on any of that stuff. Now, I know I love America first, but gosh, I just want to do something for those poor people. That's why, for the first time ever, we are going to offer the Haitian people the Sarah Palin Insurance Plan for America, Rapture Insurance. Did you know that it is a fact that Rapture Insurance is the only insurance you will need in the end times, which are here? That's right. Who needs health insurance when God does the picking anyway? For 6 easy payments, and let me tell you what, that's a deal. That's almost worth almost any price. To know that you won't have to spend eternity with Satan's witches pecking out your eyeballs. So tune in this Thursday night from 9 to 10:30 for the Oil and Uzi Show with Sarah Palin. Hey, that's me. Sponsored by Kraft Foods, Union My Ass, and Glock, just point and click.
KPFT Houston.
Not a great day for satire or comedy, so, well, instead of trying to be clever, we shall attempt to be interesting. And here to help with the interesting thing is Cliff Smith, KPFT programmer and proprietor of the Community Dialogue on Sunday evenings at 11 p.m., followed by Songlines at midnight. And I don't mean to embarrass you, Cliff, but I'm going to do a plug for Songlines here. KPFT is a station that takes its music very seriously. And within that context, Songlines, which is my favorite show, stands out very prominently. And I would like to describe it as 2 hours of stuff you'd probably never heard before, but want to hear again. So if your musical consciousness has not been beaten down and relentlessly hammered into a narrow slice of derivative self-perpetuating genre, you should tune into Songlines Sunday midnights and experience a wider range of musical expression than what is typically broadcast anywhere. Cliff is joining me this evening to attempt the impossible, a history of Haiti in 30 minutes. So I'm going to start at the beginning here. Kind of blow through the first 400 years. Haiti is currently a nation located on the western third of a Caribbean island we call Hispaniola, which it shares with the Dominican Republic. It is the tallest of the Caribbean islands, and I'm going to ask the imaginary Innerside Classroom what social movements are facilitated by mountainous regions. Anybody? No, you in the back row. Tori? That's right, guerrilla warfare. That's right. And who could tell me what role guerrilla warfare plays in an oppressive colonial disaster. You in the front row with the tight miniskirt and the fishnet. Slaver vaults. Very good. You should come in after class for some extra credit sometime. That guy in the front row with a miniskirt is pretty hot. But long before slaver vaults, the island of Hispaniola had already become the most important point on the globe. It is where world history, as we know it, began. The island was inhabited by people known as the Taino. Does anybody know what the Tainos called the island? Anybody? No, not Puerto Rico. They called it Haiti, or Haiti, as I learned from my Haitian friend. But anyway, we're going to call it Haiti because we're speaking U.S. American. World history began when the Europeans, notable for being the last people on the planet to figure out that the world was round, landed on the island of Haiti in 1492 under the command of a murderous rat, a.k.a. Christopher Columbus. This was also the birth of modern capitalism, as this was probably the first example of an excursion underwritten by a group of elite financiers who expected a considerable return on their investment. Now, listeners to the station and Howard Zinn readers are well aware of the fate of the Taino population. Suffice to say that as a direct result of Columbus, his crews, and military appointees, 10 to 20 million indigenous peoples in the Caribbean and Latin America were slaughtered, worked to death, or died of European diseases for which they had no immunity in less than 30 years. That's 20 million without the aid of mechanized transport, heavy machine guns, gas chambers, or nukes. So the 20th century has nothing new. Don't believe the hype. The very idea of celebrating Columbus Day is a testament to a ghastly ritual of hideous U.S. American racism. We don't celebrate Pol Pot today. Why does America hate Asians? Anyway, that set the tone for the European diplomatic relations with the indigenous American peoples right off the bat, or spear, as the case may be. It took the Spanish about 100 years to murder every living thing and ravage the environment. Around 1600, they were all out of children to work the mines, so they all moved over to Santo Domingo on the other side of the island, operating Spanish ports and hunkered down against the pirates. Big mistake. British, Dutch, and French pirates established bases on the island's abandoned northern and western coast and hammered Spanish shipping and ports into submission. Now, the Spanish, known more for their barbarity than brains, were easy pickings at this point because King Philip was in charge at the time. Philip was the product of centuries of royal inbreeding, was physically deformed and mentally retarded. While sitting on the porch playing the banjo one day, he decided to invade England, so he sent every naval warship and impressed every Spanish merchant vessel, then sent all 4,000 of them to the North Sea, where 90% of them broke up and sank. The rest were destroyed by the British Navy, who kept their distance, took their time, and sniped them with long-range cannon fire, which was a new technology at the time. All made easier when your opponents are mostly starving and diseased after 4 months of surfing hurricanes. A few of the Spanish managed to sink and wash up on the Irish shore, where the ever-fun-loving Irish promptly robbed and slaughtered them right on the beach, sparing a number of the hapless sailors to use as farm animals. Their descendants became known as the Black Irish. The Spanish Armada debacle was the end of Spanish naval domination, and the French pirates went legit, settled down to spend more time with their families, moving into the colonial vacuum on Haiti, which became the busiest and most important maritime port in the New World. The geographically misnamed French East India Company took possession of the West Coast, named it St. Dominique, but we're just going to keep calling it Haiti, and began establishing sugar, tobacco, and cotton plantations, prompting the importation of African slaves. Slave insurrections were frequent, and some slaves escaped to the mountains, where they were met by what would be one of the last generations of Taino natives. After the last Taino died, the full-blooded Arawakan population on the island was extinct. This is about 1700. Within 50 years, Haiti exported 123 million pounds of sugar and 2 million pounds of cotton. It was one of the richest colonies in the 18th century French Empire. By the 1780s, they produced 40% of all the sugar and 60% of all the coffee consumed in Europe. the single colony, roughly the size of Maryland or Belgium, produced more sugar and coffee than all of Britain's West Indian colonies combined. West Indian means Caribbean. The labor for these plantations was provided by an estimated 800,000 African slaves, accounting for a third of the entire Atlantic slave trade in the late 1800s. Conditions were so brutal, it was impossible to maintain a domestic slave population because the Africans died off faster than they could reproduce. And from 1790 onward, the colony imported more than, wait a minute, 40,000 slaves a year, which meant that a significant percentage of the slave population in Haiti was born in Africa. And this is why Haiti, to this day, is the most African place in the New World. And if you listen to song lines, you'd already know that because you'd hear it in the music. Right? Cliff is kicking back too hard here, man. Anyway, that's the end of my intro. And does that seem to ring true with what you know about the Atlantic slave trade?
Sure. I mean, I don't really know. I quite understand why you got me to come down here.
Because I have somebody to talk to. But you're going to be real hard to talk to, huh?
No. Forgive me, I'm just rather cynical. The United States doesn't care about Haiti, and all the reporters who are climbing all over each other to point a camera someplace, they don't care either. It's just a nice news story that they can exploit.
Oh, we should turn up your mic more, she's saying.
That's probably a good idea.
Anyway, so but it's interesting that the paradox of slavery being so brutal there that we had this constant influx of Africans into Haiti.
Yes and no. I mean, you know, we have a lot to learn from that element of the New World population. I mean, other black people, other black cultures. So it won't hurt us to be a little closer to Vodun or a little closer to Afro-Haitian culture. I mean, it just gives us access that we wouldn't normally have to a part of Africa we don't really realize. I mean, they're no more impressed than we are, actually. We just have illusions because we get to drive cars.
And, yeah, right, and get to eat more.
Yeah, we just get to help poison ourselves, and they have to take the back-breaking hit. You know, you remember when chief exports of Haiti, maybe right before Aristide took power, were baseballs, cadavers, and blood plasma.
Right, I remember the baseballs.
Yeah, and the blood plasma and the cadavers. But
and now it's probably kidneys. We just haven't heard about it yet.
You know, that's an interesting point. It probably is something like that, but they're still poor, and I guess that's part of the history. There's somebody close to me that is always talking about, why do they have so many kids? The kids are going to starve, so why would you bring a lot of children into the world for them to go through this? Probably because they're human,
yeah.
And they want to, regardless of how poor they are, they can't help but want to extend their species, and or their particular culture.
And they're Catholic.
That probably has a little bit to do with it, yeah, because there's always somebody telling them to procreate, to have more children. I don't know. Catholicism in Haiti is always been very
weird.
It's a thin veneer of Vodun, voodoo, as Europeans call it. And it's not the ordinary kind of,
Catholicism.
Irish Catholic-led priesthood, you know?
Not at all.
So it's a little bit different.
I ran into that actual form of Catholicism. What I learned from researching today was that there was there was a revolutionary period when a lot of people fled, and a lot of people fled to Louisiana.
Oh, yeah.
And the people that that I knew when I was working in Louisiana were very, very Arcadian, you know, very Cajun, very French.
The Creole.
The white people, though.
Yeah.
The white people. And because it's on this side of Louisiana, the western side. And anyway, we began to talk about healers and stuff like that. And they practice all kinds of stuff where they, you know, sacrifice when you're sick. Mm-hmm. You know, and they have a rosary in one hand and they're killing a chicken with the other. And this guy's serious. You know, this was serious stuff. This is what they grew up with, and they'd still do it. You know, burn incense, you know, shake some beads, kill a chicken, and you know, do some incantations and do the rosary and say some Hail Marys. Weird stuff.
Yeah.
Not your sister Helen Prejean, by any means.
No, and. Well, there's a lot to the Verdun. You won't see white Cajuns practicing either. I mean,
no, I'll share.
It's Creole culture.
Yeah, they didn't share everything like that. Yeah. Well, let's move on here. Thousands of slaves found freedom by fleeing into the mountains, as we suggested.
Well, they
earlier.
Did the same thing in Jamaica. They
Absolutely.
Did the same thing in the South here, or they joined with some Native American tribe. A freed slave was something that freaked white folks out constantly.
Or an escaped slave. Right?
Yeah, and then they really were freaked out after. That's why United States governments always had a certain attitude about what was going on in Haiti.
Oh, yeah.
After Haitians freed themselves from slavery, and what was that? Was it 1804 when they were founding a nation state?
Right.
They just were not trusted. They would never forgive them. Never.
Right.
Ever.
Because they were trying to protect the slave state in the United
yeah.
States. And, of course, they were able to use Haiti as the boogeyman to scare all the stupid, ignorant white people in the South. So slave revolt, there could be a slave revolt, and get in them basically to fight for the landowners to keep the slaves. Screwing their own self-interest, because if you're a poor white working class person, there's no way you're going to be able to compete with slavery. So that's what they used to keep the white people stupid enough to work against their own interests, which in many ways perseveres to this day.
There was never any realistic expectations any white folks were going to get it. Besides maybe some body like John Brown, who got hung for it.
Right.
They weren't going to get it.
Right. But
I mean, John Brown was a bit of a, I don't know what to call, a fundamentalist fanatic.
Right.
And he had his own prejudices against black people, but he just had his own hatred for slavery.
Yeah, and he had his own creepy side as well. Yeah.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Anyway, the thousands of slaves found freedom by fleeing into the mountains, because when you got a big mountain there, it's a big advantage for guerrilla warfare, because shooting downhill, I mean, things go a lot further. Bullets, spears, rocks, everything. Having the high ground. They formed communities of Maroons and raided plantations. The most famous was a guy called Macandel, a one-armed slave originally from Guinea, who escaped in 1751. He united many of the different Maroon bands, and he spent 6 years staging... Well, this speaking of John Brown.
Mm-hmm.
He united many of the different Maroon bands. He spent 6 years staging successful raids and evading capture by the French, repeatedly killing over 6,000 people while preaching a fanatic vision of the destruction of white civilization in Haiti. In 1758, after a failed plot to poison the drinking water of the plantation owners, he was captured and burned alive. First major slave revolt guy, you know, because he was fighting back. He's doing something different than just escaping.
Slave revolts were constant, just like Spartacus in Rome. I mean, it's just constant.
Well, it's interesting that we brought him up right after John Brown, because he was a voodoo priest,
yeah.
You know. And so, you know, the whole thing was wrapped up in the same kind of fundamentalism. And the promise of course, the Sky Dad, you know, if things go wrong. You get to go to heaven.
Hmm.
So get out there and get out there and run on point. Boy. Anyway, where were we? So Haiti also had the largest and wealthiest free population of color in the Caribbean, known as the Gens de Color, which is French for people of color. The mixed race community in Haiti numbered 25,000 in 1789. First generation's Gens de Color were typically the offspring of a male French slave owner and a raped slave concubine. In the French colonies, the semi-official institution of placage, I think that's how you say that, defined this practice. By this system, the children were free people and could inherit property, thus originating a class of mulattoes, with property and some with wealthy fathers. This occupied a middle status between African slaves and French colonists. Some African national immigrants also enjoyed status as gens de couleur. Haiti is a land of eternal contradictions, and this is one of them, because you have the African slaves being worked to death on plantations without a second thought, yet the institution of slavery and intermarriage is a liberal paradise in comparison to North America practice.
Just one of the peculiarities of the French. I mean, you got, in the 20s, you had jazz musicians being feted as heroes of unprecedented prowess on the horn, and you had, you know, within 10, 15 years, Africans living in France were living in hovels carved out of stone, you know, to buildings that had collapsed, they'd dig a hole and sleep in there. I'm just sort of pointing out the contradictions.
Lots of them.
I mean, you know.
The French. As the numbers of gens de couleur grew, the French rulers enacted discriminatory laws. I guess you could call those the gens de couleur. Statutes forbade gens de couleur from taking up certain professions, marrying whites, wearing European clothing, carrying swords or firearms in public, or attending social functions where whites were present. However, these regulations did not restrict the purchase of land, and many accumulated substantial holdings and became slave owners. By 1789, they owned one-third of the plantation property and one-quarter of the slaves in Haiti. For simplicity's sake, we're now to assume that the French and the British are in constant state of war, okay? Which is close enough for radio. So we're now in the summer of 1789. My favorite revolution of all time, the French Revolution. Off with their heads. They're fooling around. And while the French settlers in Haiti debated how the new revolutionary laws would apply, outright civil war broke out when the freemen of color claimed they too were French citizens under the terms of the Declaration of the Rights of Man, which was the revolutionary document, sort of like the Constitution, or the, you know, that...
Well, that's what the French government used.
Right.
That's what Napoleon used to try to stop.
Well, this was before Napoleon, right? Just before,
yeah.
Right.
Well, that's what they used to try to stop the rebellion.
10 days before the fall of the Bastille, the French seated 6 Haitian delegates within a year. The National Assembly granted full civic rights to the gens de couleur. When the delegation returned to Haiti and submitted these reforms to the governor, they just told him to take a hike. So after his demands were refused, Auguet and Jean-Baptiste Chavannes, a veteran of the American Revolution, led a rebellion of the gens de couleur. However, the mulatto rebels refused to arm or free their slaves or to challenge the status of slavery. Their attack was rebuffed by a force of white militia and black volunteers, and they were hanged. A year later, slaves in the northern region of the colony staged a revolt that began the Haitian Revolution. Read by Duddy Bookman, within hours, the northern plantations were in flames. The rebellion spread through the entire colony. Bookman was, of course, hanged, but the rebellion continued to spread rapidly. This prompted the French to send a character by the name of Santanax. Does that sound familiar? Santanax, who was sent to Haiti to maintain French control, stabilize the colony, and enforce the social equality recently granted to the free people of color by the National Convention of France. Santanax took the radical step of proclaiming the freedom of the slaves with severe limits on their freedoms. Soon, emancipation was extended throughout the colony, and by 1794, the French National Convention ratified the act, outlawed slavery in all French colonies. So, I mean, once again, Haiti is like at the center of change. From, you know, the minute Columbus hits till freeing of so-called freeing of slaves in the colonies.
Sort of a shell game, do we call it, electoral politics.
Right.
Here.
But there is some, yeah, right, exactly. But there is, you know, progress being made. So anyway, the slaves did not immediately flock to Sonthonax's banner, by the way. White colonists resisted and were joined by many of the freemen of color who opposed the abolition of slavery. And it was not until the words of France's ratification of emancipation arrived back in the colony that Toussaint Louverture and his corps of well-disciplined, battle-hardened former slaves switched sides, joined the French Republicans. By the time Sonthonax returned to France, the former slaves were not only freed, but armed. Haiti was immediately invaded by the British. Louverture successfully drove back the British by 1798, was the de facto ruler of the colony. In 1799, he also defeated the rebellious mulatto general, André Rigaud, who controlled most of the South and the West, who refused to acknowledge Toussaint's authority. By 1801, he was in charge of Spanish Santo Domingo and proclaiming the abolition of slavery there. Toussaint did not, however, proclaim full independence for the country, nor did he seek reprisals against the country's former white folks, slave or slaveholders, convinced that the French would not restore slavery. So, man, we only got to 1800. It's a very colorful... But I had to say one thing, that everything that Americans think about themselves, about the little guy going up against the great empire and justice prevailing, is much more true there over and over again than it has ever been here. But unfortunately, we refuse to accept that as being real, because it ain't us.
And we started off the show with Stacy Davis as Sarah Palin, followed by The History of Haiti Up to 1800, with me, Scooter, and Cliff Smith. This has been the Interside Radio Program. See y'all next week.
Tonight from Haiti, tens of thousands of people are feared dead following a devastating earthquake.
Good evening once again from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, a city, a nation that is increasingly tense. It's fair to say the people here increasingly skeptical.
Thousands made homeless from Haiti's massive earthquake woke up after a third night in makeshift tents.
Dire need, desperate conditions continue after this tragedy, this 7.0 magnitude quake.
The nation cries for help in a frantic search for survivors.
In the St. George area of the city, an urban square has become a makeshift campsite for hundreds of homeless and dispossessed.
The world races
There's
to the rescue.
There's running water here, but food, supplies, and optimism are scarce.
We have to be there for them in their hour of need.
Our people are dying because we have
there
sick people.
There is a tremendous struggle to get aid to the people here, say nothing of bringing it onto
it
this island nation.
It is a grisly scene
nation.
Here in the city. Bodies in the
onto
streets.
This island nation. And we learned tonight the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, is due in this country. All of the members of our on-air team were out reporting.
And as we left, a heart-rending cry from her neighbor.
Everyone is talking about the same damn thing. Everyone knows about it.
The airport
everyone's talking about the same thing.